Well, Judy, as you would like, you'd sooner have my life story on a tape than on a book. So what I've got written, I will put down. Well, here it is, December the 26th, 1976. This is Nancy's birthday. She's 17 today. We've had a nice Christmas with Neil, Judy, and Craig on a mission. It's the only time that I can ever see that we could have three missionaries out at once. And this is really nice. I'm starting my life story. I'm going to write it in parts. In my lifetime, we have gone from the horse and buggy days to the flying and landing on the moon. I would tell my kids about the horse age. My father was a good horseman and always had good horses. Now I'm going to stop here and see if this will. I'm going to repeat this. My father was a good horseman and always had good horses. He always said not to whip a horse or a kid when you was mad, because you would overdo it. I can't remember who told me this story. It said that my dad had a team. They were brown, bald-faced, and stocking-legged. As I told Owen this story, he said he thought the team was named Rob and Fox. Dad used this team to make his living. He was hauling beets, and the road were all dirt, and they would be big mud holes. The man told me that Dad would drive to the mud hole and then Wendy's team and go halfway through and then stop in Wendy's team and then pull on through. He always carried a whip, but they never saw him use it. In this horse age, if a person had a good team and wagon, he could haul freight all year round and make a good living. So as kids come along, it was the standard way to raise a pair of colts and let the boy break them as a team. Dad started out with some Hamiltonians. They were about like thoroughbreds. You could ride them and work them. They would weigh about 1,000 to 1,200 pounds. They would cross them with a heavy draft breed of horses such as the Shire, Perchin, Clydesdale, or Belgian. Dad crossed with a Shire, and the best horse we had as I was a boy was a mare of this background that we call Babe. It was Reed's turn to have a team, so Dad made an arrangement with Hiram Caron, that's Sid Caron's dad, who had a two-year-old stallion from a Belgian stallion and a Perchin mare. The mare used was Babe and Bird. The colts we got were a pair of mare colts. Babe's colt was named Jane, and Bird's colt was named Jip. Now Babe was the best, was a lot better horse than Bird, and their colts was a lot better horses than Bird's colt was. As we started to break them, Reed left on a mission, and I drove them the 2 years that he was gone. So I always thought I had a part in them. When they were 4 years old, Owen and I pulled them in the pulling match here in Lewiston. It was either the 4th or 24th of July, I'm not sure. This mare Jane would give you everything she had, and I don't remember whipping her. But Jip would pull out of fear, and her memory wasn't very long. And Jip wasn't as stout as Jane, and that made a problem. So we set the sink tree over so that Jane would have to pull the biggest share. Jane had a habit, she would, if she ever got a leg over the tub, that run down from the hame to the single tree, she would kick straight back and get in. This day that Owen and I pulled in the match in Lewiston, she got out of the tugs on one side, and I was holding the bits. And I was a tall, skinny kid. And the big fat man standing there thought he could help me. He walked up and went to take a hold of the tug. And I let go of the team and pushed him back in time that Jane just missed him. I told him afterwards that I was sorry, but that was her job to get back in the tug. She worked a hardship on Owen to drive. It was a rule at the match that you couldn't whip the team or swear, so Owen had to change his way of driving. And it put him up at a disadvantage. Then Owen would get a little stage fright. I would tell him to holler louder. But he worked. But he would say, "I'm hollering just as loud as I can." At home, he could make more noise than that. When Reed came home, we made a driver out of him for the pulling matches. He learned to talk on the street corner, and driving in a pulling match was about like a street meeting anyway. You had to talk loud enough so that everybody could hear, including your team. When Reed came home, he traded Jip off for a mare we called Babe. So his team was Jane and Babe. And he would pull them of the team. He would outpull most of the teams. And he would holler Jane. And the pulling meter would keep coming. I remember I was on a mission and he sent me $50 and his first prize winnings, and I bought a new suit. That was sure a good suit, and it was sure needed. As he was getting ready to go for the pulling match at Richmond Black and White Bay, I think in 1942, he had traded Babe off for a mare that he called Nell. And she got hurt, and that left him with just one horse named Jane. So he went with Ned Spackman from Richmond, who just had one horse ready, and Ned drove. They had to get special permission from the Black and White Committee to do this at that late date. And Jim Murray was the chairman. Said it was all right with him because matching a team that late, he could not pull him. But the thing he didn't know was that Ned's horse would do all she could for Ned. And it didn't matter to Jane because she would give you everything she had. As the match was coming to an end, Reed asked Ned to holler Jane, and holler loud. Ned said, "She's out pulling my mare now." And Reed said, "Do you want to win?" He said, "Yes." And he said, "All right, then scream Jane just as many times as you can, and just as loud as you can, and you can win." So that is the way he did. He won the match. But about 6 weeks after that, Jane died one night. We as a family loved that mare. And it it almost ruined the Rawlings Pullington. I was on a mission, and I think everybody would have had a funeral for her if it would have been legal. I think I should go back and tell about Owen's team. It must have been about 1929 or 30. He took this mare called Babe and raised Colt McClydesdale Stallion that he called Tex. And for a mate to him, they traded and got a mare, a colt, from George Rawlings that was out of the same stallion, and the mare that George had. And he named her Jen. So this was a good team. And Owen did a lot of Holland beats and fall and Holland gravel and whatever thing. But Cache County would open gravel pits at different places in the county and let everybody haul gravel for so much a cubic yard. And in a long day with a team, you could make two loads, and Owen and Howard would haul with two teams, and Reed and I would milk the cows. The cows would be in the barn, and they had drinking cups so they could get a drink, and the barn was full of hay. We would milk about six cows each in the morning and the same at night and go to school. And Owen and Howard would leave about 5 o'clock in the morning, the two teams, and get back after dark. And lots of times they would walk behind the wagon or at the side of the horse so they could keep warm. In the summer, we would spend about a month hauling wood out of the High Creek Canyon. We would haul green maple and dry pine. We always had a grain binder, rather. And it would cut the grain and tie it in a bundle. We did this for so much an acre. And we would take teams, take turns driving the binder. And my job was to take them a change of teams about noon and take the boys, either Howard or Owen or Reed, and then drive for a while they ate their dinner and have a little rest. We would change teams several times as needed, as three times a day. As often as three times a day. One time I was changing teams at Joe Hire's place. He lived where Grant Flagler now lives. As was the custom, every farm had a few milk cows. The cows were trained, so in the summer you'd take the bucket and the stool, go out and sit in the corral, and milk the cow. They would just stand there. We were changing teams right by the corral. Owen and I was making the change, and Joe Hire was milking his cow out in the corral, and the cow name, we found out later, was named Sweetheart. Well, Joe's wife was holding the cow's tail, and Joe was a milking along and saying, "So, sweetheart, so, sweetheart." And the cow's tail came loose from his wife's hand and let Joe have it right in the mouth. And Joe said, "So, you old son of a bitch." And his wife grabbed the cow's tail, and Joe went on saying, "So, sweetheart, so, sweetheart." Now I asked Owen, was Joe talking to the cow or the wife? And he said he didn't know. But months later, we found in the testing report that Joe did have a cow named Sweetheart. So I guess that's who he was talking to. Now back to this team of Owens, Tex and Jen. They were a brown pair of about the same size. Tex was the biggest horse, was the best horse to work, but when you got uptown to the pulling match, Jen was the best. She was one of those horses that liked to pull. I would guess about 1932, a siege of brain fever came through this country and killed a lot of good horses, and Tex was our loss to that disease. Now, Jen used to make Owens mad. She was lazy, and in her stall in the barn at night, she would kick the side of the stall. She had two names. If we ever bought a horse or a cow, we always named them after the man's wife. When Owen would start to whip Jen, he changed her name to Nellie, who was George Owens' wife's name. And I can still hear my mother trying to get on to quit using the name of Nellie. But all her efforts were in vain. Now, Jen was the first good pulling horse that the Rollinses had. We matched her with everything in the neighborhood. And she would be standing there about asleep. And I would go up and undo the overcheck and walk around the front and take a hold of her bit, and she would throw her head up and was ready to go. And it would take a horse 200 pounds bigger to even stay with her. It always seemed to me that we had one horse that would pull, and the mate was willing to let her. I was hauling hay with Jen, and a half-witted colt, and eased through a ditch and whipped a load of hay and got stuck. The colt jumped around there instead of pulling, and I couldn't get out. So I tied up the lines and got a chain and tied Jen Singletree to the wagon and undone her overcheck and walked around in front and took a hold of her bit, and she come alive. She thought she was at the pulling match. And then I jumped aside of the colt and stayed a hold of the colt. And when Jen had pulled out the load, I said, "Whoa," and she stopped. Went right back to sleep. But I was out of the ditch, and I got up on the wagon and went to the stack. This old shed in the northwest corner of the barn was the shed used to park the white top buggy. Now, the white top buggy had two seats in it. There was a curtain that could be pulled so you could drive in the rain and stay partly dry. Now, Orson Owen had been somewhere and was coming home, and they were wondering which horse could outrun. Our white top buggy was pulled by team, so they were coming into town from the east. It was coming just as fast as that team could run, with the help of a buggy hood. Now, Dad's brother, Frank Rollins, lived where Farrell Smith lives. Called up Dad and said, "Alf, your team has run away." Dad said, "Are they running straight down the road?" Frank said, "Yes." "Did you see the buggy hood?" Frank said, "Yes." "Well, then the boys are trying to see which horse is the fastest." While Dad and Frank were talking, team came in the yard and backed the buggy into the shed. So Dad thanked Frank for telling him the story. When Owen and Horse came in, Dad asked him which horse could run the fastest. They were quite surprised that he knew all about it. So Dad said, "If you don't want me to know, run your horse races on a road where there isn't a telephone." When Reed graduated from high school, I think 1932, after the beets were all topped and there was a big pile of beets down at the factory, that was hauled over the B dump and run into the factory. Now, those beets had to be pitched in the wagon with fart. So Dad told him that he should get Regnal, brought him, commonly known Rags, to work with him and go haul beets. Now, I think Owen and Howard were hauling together with a team. It took two men to a wagon. Uncle Gaudier Hogan was the field man for the sugar factory and was in charge of lining up the teams. His wife was Dad's sister, Aunt Mint, or Minta, I guess was her name. So Dad called Gowdy and asked him to stop anyone talking. When he stopped in, Dad asked him about reading Rags hauling beets. But Gowdy said, if they can live the rules, we don't want any playing around, and we want them to load so they don't get stuck. And we want them to work. Dad said that is the rules that I would use anyway. So they fixed up the wagon and used Babe and Bird. One day about the time as I was coming home from school, Uncle Gowdy stopped in and said, Alf, that was the name everybody knew Dad by, the boys almost got stuck today. And that Reed took a whip and whipped those old mares of yours right good. Dad said, did they pull the load? Uncle said, yes. Dad said, good, that's just what I would have done to them. Uncle said, it reminded me of you, and I thought you'd like to know. The Rollins boys always worked together. We had a hay crew all by ourselves. I was the derrick boy. Now, the derrick boy had two jobs. He rode the horse to pull the hay from the wagon to the stack. And the other job was to take the blame for what went wrong. Now, that's all I got in the book. So I'm going to tell you the rest of this story right freelance again. Right down on the corner south of us here, right to where Steve Bodley's house is, we were putting up a big stack of hay. There was a big barbed wire fence right out there that made the corner going both ways. Made a good corner. And Ariel run the fork, one stacked. I run the dairy horse. Dad sat out in the street in your Model T Ford. Reed run a wagon, Reed loaded, horse and hard pitched, and made, and we put another wagon on. Now, I believe maybe we'd hired a pitcher at that time, but anyway, we put another wagon on. I guess we had to run three wagons. May drove back and forth between and Reed loaded. I guess the horse and hard was loaded. But anyway, and put in his third wagon in the business. It wasn't a very good wagon. It didn't have all the boards on the bottom. After you got the hay thick enough, why, it was saved fairly good. And the wind was starting to blow. It was a little after dinner. And Ariel had said, now you, when I raise my hand, you get up there, you hit that old mare, and you get this hay up on that stack. Before that wind blows it over again, that stack, and all the hay falls off, fart, and I have to go again. Well, he raised his hand, and he raised his hand too quick. And I hit this old Babe that I rode. She was a good stout mare, good horse. And the fork, one of the four times of this Jackson fork, had gone down through the floor and around a cross member of the wagon. And as I hit old Babe, I felt her groan a little more than usual, and I looked back. And up was going the wagon and the hay and Ariel. And he got excited, and just about this time I said, whoa, and jumped off that old mare and dove through that fence to the north, just like a hound dog, I guess. Because about that time, Ariel tripped the fork and fell on the ground, and the hay on Ariel, and the wagon on hay. And I knew the course of events. And so did Dad. Dad was a crippled man, and he walked with a cane, and he started getting out of that old Ford. Well, I dove through that fence and ran across that road and headed for home, right up this road, as hard as I could come. When Dad got to the fence, he met Ariel crawling through that fence. And he said, now, Ariel, you go back and straighten out that mess. Not till I've whipped that kid, he said. Owen said, if you've got to whip somebody, then you let me down, and I'll take the kid's part. But today, the kid don't get whipped. Dad said, that's right. Now, you leave him alone. And he said, not till I whip that kid. And there was quite a discussion between Dad, Nolan, and Ariel. Finally, Ariel backed off. But had they not have done, he would have chased me clear up that road. Now, if I could have got home, I might could have got on my saddle horse and kept out of his sight. I don't know. But he would have beat me half to death. But Owen finally hooped and hollered and got me stopped. And I tormented Ariel about this because the dang guy, he used to tune us up every once in a while as younger kids until we got big enough that, I don't know, he didn't have a good, very good sense of humor, I guess, but I've chided him about this story and he just sits there and grins. You don't say yay or nay, but that was, I'd been Derek Boy a long time and I knew just exactly what my treatment was going to be. But anyway, they got me back down there. And I said, and Dad said, come on, you're safe. And I said, yeah, I trust you, but I don't trust him. But anyway, we made it through the day. And that was Dad's job anyway, was to keep peace. Send a bunch of boys out and send a bunch of kids out to work. And I know what that is. Dad used to say that you send somebody out to do a job and you say, one boy was a boy, two boys half boy, three boys no boy at all. Then raising our seven boys with three girls. I've thought about that many times. Now this hay crew business was quite a thing. There was another hay crew, and I'm gonna leave out some of the names for various reasons. But they were the big hay crew. The Karen hay crew. And I think Hiram Karen told the story on Lorraine. And if this is wrong, why, I'm sorry, but then this way it was told to me. But anyway, Lorraine's boy had ridden the horse. He was a little boy. Gosh, you'd start a kid out before you'd go to school. They'd ride a horse. Well, Derek, two or three years before he went to school, had a good horse. Oh, Lorraine, he cussed that kid. And it was time to go to school, and they were still doing third crop hay. The boy wanted to go to school, and his dad said, not that we get that hay up. His mother said, yes, you will, and I'll lead the Derek horse. Well, Jaime said, you know, it was just a revelation to that hay crew. He'd want that to come back a little bit, and he'd say, Mother dear, would you back up just a little bit further? That wasn't the way he had talked to the Derek boy. Now, looks like we're about out of tape right here. Well, as I grew up, my means of travel was a saddle mare, saddle horse. Now, I started out on a few, but really my first horse was a gray mare. Golly, I'm trying to remember her name. Snip. She was single foot, that's a pace. She was an easy riding mare. every place I went with her. And if I was late for school, I'd throw the bridle on her and jump on her and ride her to school. And leave the reins tied up and bail off. And she'd turn around and come home. Now, I delivered papers as a boy all through those Depression years. This was the mare that I rode. Winter and summer, rain or snow, or 30 below, or whatever. So I always had a few dollars in my pocket delivering the papers. And I could, every morning, get up and go deliver those papers. And that was quite a job. Now, Dave Norton, this was Laura Jack's father, they delivered the Desert News at night. Now back to this newspaper story. In the summertime, Dave and Orton delivered the Desert News. I think they had a bigger route than I did. It was more of a popular magazine, or a paper. It was all church-sponsored. In the early days, the Trib was started out by the anti-Mormons, but it kind of called off the war, at least. Some people did. But anyway, Dave would deliver news to his family. They had a big bunch of kids. He was the same age as Dad. And kids were about the same number and about the same age. And anyway, Arthur, I think, was a couple years older than I was, and he was their last one. I was Dad's last one, and anyway, about the same number of kids. And they used to deliver the newspaper at night, and they'd milk half a dozen cows, and they'd sell milk around town. Dave had a gallon bucket. He'd carry milk over and pour it into their container and go back and pick up milk. He'd deliver milk in the morning and newspaper at night. Well, Dave was a kind of a jovial old fellow, and he kept tormenting me. I was just a kid. Good land, I was just a kid. And he tormented me about ancient history peddler. He said, I've delivered all that news last night. Well, I could match wits with him on that. I had enough experience. I said, well, that's all right. I said, you old sour milk peddler, I said, you're so slow delivering that milk, that milk's sour before you get there. And so I didn't try to run competition with him on newspapers. I just called him sour milk peddler. That was a standard name. Now, May and one of the girls, can't remember whether it was Jesse or Afton, one of them, chased around together all the time. One day, May had been over there, and I don't know, Dave, he was a-grumbling about me calling him the sour milk peddler. I don't think he told anything about the other part of that story, but anyway, May got after me and said, you have got to quit calling him the sour milk peddler. Well, this daddy perked up and said, hey, what's going on? What's happening? So I went on to explain. I said, well, every time I see him, he calls me the ancient history peddler. Claimed he'd already delivered that news the night before, and here I was coming in behind times. And I said, I can't match with him on that. I don't really care. So I just tell him that milk he carries around to give to people, he's dang slow, that milk all turns sour, and so he's just sour milk peddler. And May said, yes, and he don't like that. Dad laughed and said, oh, leave Little alone, he's all right. Dave should be able to take it. He said, he hands it out, he always has, said that sounds all right to me. He said, I wouldn't worry about it. Anyway, this is where I almost got took one day by old Arthur. Arthur stopped me and wanted to run me a race, run my horse a race. for foot, on foot, or foot. I don't remember how he worded it, but anyway, he worded it, all he had to do was beat that horse for a foot. And I learned then that if you want to listen pretty close, what people telling you, but this paper business, my golly, that was that come. That darn thing went every day. You went to church, you get up early enough and got it done. I guess that's where I learned to go on a dead run and to get there in a hurry. And to try and run jobs day and night. Now, maybe some of you kids can see why I've sent you off on jobs to do jobs to work for people. I got to think here for a minute. Oh, it must have been about 1932 or 3 or something. Maybe in 1930. But anyway, we had an earthquake. And I was riding the horse that morning. It was, I can't remember, it was spring or fall. But anyway, Daryl Hendricks lived down on this corner south of me, right across the road there. Their home's still there. And they always took the Tribune, and one of my best customers. And so I'd gallop down there and give them their newspaper, and I was riding this snip mare of mine right along there, and she almost fell down. Now that was quite unusual for her to fall. And I thought, good land, old mare, you got awkward. And I delivered the paper and came home and proceeded to get my clothes changed, go to school. Mother said, we've had a slight earthquake this morning. And I said, how long ago? And she told me, and I said, by golly, that's why that mare almost fell down. And so anyway, went over to school, and oh my land, I had a great big old three-story building. Over there was big and square, and brick building. It was a well-built building. And we didn't have fire escapes in that building. But gosh, we had been practicing fire drills in that building for years. And so if any emergency come, we could just march right out of there right in style. But right on that second floor, middle, we was right in the change of classes. And that hall was chock full. And there was our principal, Mr. Stoddard, Carl Stoddard. And the teachers all right there. And then come the second wave of that earthquake. And that old building began to sway. And Carl Stoddard looked at us, and down those stairs he went, and right out that door with those teachers behind him and those kids, all us kids, just pouring out of that building. Dead run, no sense of order, no line of order, or nothing. We run off down the road there, down the playground to the west somewhere. Oh, about to where that new building is, I guess almost to where Homer Bergerson lives. Yeah. Sit down there and waited. Waited and waited and waited and waited. And we kept wondering what was going on. And I said, well, Mother said that had an earthquake. And I guess that was the second. Sometimes they come a wave or two. But anyway, a little while, why somebody get out there by the building and shook that old bell. Now, even called us all back up there, and by then Brother Stoddard, our principal, had got his countenance back to normal. And oh, he tuned us up for not coming out of there in order and marching out like we'd been trained in fire drill. I don't think we thought any more about those fire drills than he did, and I never forgot that. I kid him about it years later, and well, he had to have something to say, and I guess that was a good thing as any. But this was my first encounter with an earthquake. Now I'm going to tell you a part of my life that's real tough to tell. As I had just turned 15 years of age, January of 1935, my father turned 63 the, I don't know, 1st or the 2nd of February. And I congratulated him on his birthday. He told me, he said, this is my last birthday on Earth. Now he said, my body's wore out. I'm never without pain. My, how I'd like to race you. But I can't do it. He said, I'm sorry, but I would like to race you. Now he said, there's a few things I'd like you to do. He said, I, speaking of himself, was going to go on a mission as a young man. And he said, his dad was blind at that time. And his mother had cancer, I guess, skin cancer. They used to make some homemade salve that had kind of cleared up for a while. But some of the older members of the family thought that he ought to stay home and take care of dad and mother, grandpa and grandma, his dad and mother. So he gave in to their wishes. He said, now if you get a chance, go on a mission, you go do it, regardless of where or what my condition is. Now he said, I've got so close to death that I've lost the fear of it. I have no fear of death. To a teenage boy, that was hard to understand. Now, but he said, I'd like you to bear another thing in mind. But when I'm gone, don't grieve too long or too hard. And above all, don't become bitter. And over my lifetime, I've found that there's more common sense in that little phrase than any one particular phrase I've ever known. And his health deteriorated, and because of the speech he'd give me, I watched him real close all summer. And I don't know, in November, the boys were all off working. And I don't know, there must not have been school that day or something, out for something. Anyway, I wasn't to school. And Dad had deteriorated, and he was laying on the couch in what is our front room on the west side, right over by that window. And he got to where he couldn't talk. And I went uptown for something. Mother sent me uptown after something. And I went in the bank, and Uncle Gowdy Hogan, my uncle, was there, and I said, Uncle Gowdy, Dad's health is to the point that he, I don't think, will make it through the day. And he said, my land, how are you up here? And I don't remember, but anyway, he said, I'll be right there. Well, anyway, in a few minutes, he came in the house. And I guess over the years they had had disagreements. I don't know much about it or whether there was or something. But he walked over to Dad and took Dad by the hand and said, Alf, can you still hear me? And he said, yes, I can hear you. And he nodded yes. And he said, Alf, I have made offenses to you, and I've done you wrong at times. Will you forgive me? Dad said yes. Tears came into both those men's eyes, and I saw two grown men settle differences. And then he said, I'll be right back. And he went out and got in his car and went down home and down to his home and brought that man up. And somebody brought Aunt Eulalia. No, Aunt Ev. Ev. Yeah. This was Edis's Taggart's grandmother, who was Dad's sister. And she came in, and she'd been a widow for several years. She went over and took Dad by the hand and said, "Alf, can you still hear me?" And he nodded his head. He couldn't talk. He'd gone far enough, but he couldn't talk. And he nodded his head, "Yes." And she said, "When you get over there, will you tell Joel," that was her husband, who had been dead for years, "that I've lived over here alone long enough, and I'd like to come and be with him. And will you be sure to tell him?" And Dad nodded that he would. Now, I started rounding up the family. I couldn't get some of the boys. By the time the beet coppers got here, we could get them here while Dad was gone. And that was a pretty big blow to the family. This was the patriarch of the clan. They used to claim that Owen could stack the straightest and the most beautiful stacks of hay. While Dad was there, and would say, "Owen, you're leaning that little, would you kind of got to come back this way?" And his stacks, and it never rained through. Now, for some reason or another, Owen and Dad had a communication that I think was not very often met. I'll tell you a little about that a little later on, if I can remember it. But anyway, right now I'm going on with my story. But here I was, a 15-year-old boy. As I sit there and watched my dad die, I remembered that he had asked, and my mother, Dad just kept a-looking and a-looking, and Mother just couldn't face it. Mother just couldn't face it. Now, finally somebody suggested, "Mother, you've got to come in here. He's a-looking for somebody." And she went in and sat down by the side of him and took a hold of his hand and began to cry, and he just eased down then. He knew where she was and faded away. A man who'd raised six boys and one girl. They buried one girl. And right here I should tell you a little about Ruth, about as little as I know. I never could know much about Ruth. She died before I was born. She died in November, I think, of 1918, and I was born in January of 1920. Anyway, I always thought I took her place. I don't know whether I've done it justice or not, but anyway, I asked Dad one time. I said, "Dad, I don't know anything about Ruth." And he said, "To bury that little girl was the toughest thing I ever did." And then he began to cry, and that's all I ever got out of him. I'd quit. So at another time, I asked Mother. I said, "Mother, I don't want to bother you, really. If you felt like you could tell me a little about Ruth." She didn't live very many months. Three, I believe. That could be corrected by Mayor Reed, but anyway. And Mother said, "Well, she took sick and died so fast. And Dr. Parkinson just couldn't seem to do anything about it." And Dr. Parkinson was a good doctor. And she said, "I just grieved and grieved and grieved over that loss of that little girl, and I just couldn't quit." And she said one night, she said, "I don't know whether it was a dream or whether it was a reality, but her mother came back to her and said, 'Cora, I am taking care of Ruth, and I will do it till you come to get her. Now cut it out.' And she said, after that, I quit grieving. I knew my mother would take good care of her." And she said that was the hardest thing ever done, was to bury that little girl. So the Rollins family knew, was known of six boys and one girl. Now May was married at this time. Owen was married at this time. Ariel was, so was Horace. Howard, Reed and I. Neither our dad nor our mother know I've ever met in this world our partners. And so, after the dust all cleared away, Dad had sold his property to his wife some years before he died. And all she had to do was record the deed for love and affection and a dollar. And so the property ended up all Mother's. And anyway, as we went on into the winter, we got the farm work done and I got the beets all hauled. Reed and Howard, I think, hauled beets that winter. I was going on to school. And Reed and Mother got to talking that winter. And he said, "Mother, I'd like to go fill a mission." And she said, "That's just exactly the thing to do." So between Mother and Reed and Howard and I, we sat around that breakfast table planning for Reed's mission. Howard and I told Mother and told Reed that we would see to it that Reed had his money every month for his mission. The church said $20 a month. And as I've thought about this, Owen was working for Henry Johnson. And I think he started out working for Henry Johnson for $30 a month, 6 days a week. A good 8 to 10 hours a day. And I think by the time Reed got back off his mission, he was up to 45. But you see, for a mission, and it took half a salary. I don't take quite a half a salary now. But anyway, that was our first encounter for a mission. Horace had gone on a mission. Oh, I remember when I was 6 years old, I was down at the barn cleaning bedding the cows. I'd gone down there in the winter, and in come Dad. This was in 1926. Either the fall, either the December of 25 or the January of 26. Now, I don't know which it was, but then it don't matter, but that, somewhere in that time. And Dad came in, and Owen and Horace and I was there. That was the four of us. And I don't suppose I was supposed to have been old enough to get in on this. And I didn't say anything, and that was quite unusual. But Dad said, "The bishop has come along," and this would have been, I think, Saul Heyer. I think Saul was the bishop then. And asked me if I'd send one of you boys on a mission. And I told him yes. I asked him which one he wanted. He said, "You pick them. You tell me and I'll fill out the papers." And so the discussion that went on between Owen and Horace that day and Dad. And I've since wondered, nowadays, we'd have sent them both, wouldn't we? But anyway, now Owen had taken lead for a long time. Ariel had been gone a long time. And Owen kind of took lead anyway, I believe. And somewhere you got to have somebody take lead. Owen, under Dad's direction, done a good job. Now, he and Dad had good communications. And I had a hard time learning to communicate with Owen, but I finally learned how. It was a long time after I was married, but anyway. And Owen said, "We can send Horace on a mission easier than you can if you send me." And Dad said, "Well, that's right. But then if you go, we'll try it. We'll do it. And then Horace can go and you get home." Well, anyway, Horace was the one that went on a mission. And the missionary spirit kind of got going. Dad's health was real bad, and the depression was real bad and real tough. And money didn't come very good. Horace got home in 1928. And we didn't get another missionary out till 1935. 36. May of 36, Reed went on a mission. And by golly, we'd get the milk check, and we saw to it that the first $20 went to Reed. And it got down there, and I think they sent it to him, and I'm not sure. I think a cashier's check, but I guess I have to ask Reed that one. But anyway, that was our first encounter. So he got home, but then come the blow that, and the loss of Dad. We lost the shepherd of the flock. Now, he could tell you how to run the farm, tell you what to plant, and tell you how to work it, and it grew better. It didn't grow as good without his direction. We didn't get the planting done as good, it seemed like to me. But then, after Reed left, Mother just couldn't go. And her health got down spad. And then we discovered that she had cancer of the stomach. And this was along in the summer. And along that fall, she said to me, "I'm going to have Howard take me down, lead me down to Mays." And he was married, lived in Huntsville for a week or so. And you can come get me. Can you get along? Yes, I can get along. I'll get along. I'll go to school. And we'll get her done. We'll get her done. I'd get up and milk my half the cows and get school car, go to school. I'd been the house cleaner. She told Howard on whoever was here, "Now you leave him alone. Saturday he's mine." I'd do many things to go. I'd give up the paper route then. There was more things than I could hack. Because I had to scrub the house. My mother didn't believe in mopping the house. You got right down on your knees and you scrubbed it. But I got pretty close to Mother, and so I said to Mother, as she got ready to leave, I said, "You haven't felt very good, have you?" She said, "No, I don't feel very good at all. Something's got to change. I can't do this." And I said, "Dad straightened out his property before he died. Maybe you ought to do something with yours. But whatever you do, don't put my name on it. I'm a teenager. I don't want nobody to bother me." And so that day, she gave Howard some pretty strict instructions, and I think he lived up to them as far as I know. And she deeded the place and sold it to Howard and Reed for love and affection of the daughter, with instructions when Reed get off the mission, if she didn't live that time, he could straighten it up later. Well, I got the blame for that, and I guess I did it. But as we settled up the affairs, we didn't have to give any to an attorney. And we didn't get all taxed out of. We got all we got. Now, some of the older brothers tell the story, and I'm not going to put his name in here. He'll know who I'm talking about. Brother Russell Rogers told him one day that they should have made an estate out of it and let him be the administrator. His older brother said, "You'd have starved us to death." And reached through the counter and got a hold of his tie. And the words that went between those two men been better off had they never said them, both of them. But anyway, Then came February. January, they operated on Mother. January of 1937. Sewed her back up to die. Here now in 13 months, I had to lay my mother to the side of my dad. A 17-year-old boy. I used to get so lonesome and so homesick, and yet I was home. But I'd go off by myself and sit down and bawl. Bawl like a little kid. And I'd get over it. I'd cook my own breakfast, put up my own lunch, eat my own supper, keep the house warm. And I guess I owe an apology. I owe this apology to Aunt Em. She was Mother's older sister. There was Aunt Em, Aunt Alvy, and Aunt Esther. They lived in St. Anthony, and they came to Mother's funeral. Aunt Em was alone. Her husband had been dead for several years. She'd never had any kids of her own. She decided she ought to stay here and raise me. And that was the last thing I wanted on this earth. My mother had never been very strict with me, and neither had Dad. They trusted me. And by golly, I didn't want to have to put up with her. So I asked Aunt Esther, I said, when you go home, will you take Aunt Em with you? And she did. Years later, I kind of felt a little bad the way I did it, but I'm sure glad that she went. I'm almost out of tape here. I don't know